Today we're going to have two sessions. The first session will feature the two candidates for the Commonwealth attorney race, and the second will consist of the three of the four candidates for the state senate for the 17th and 25th district. All four candidates were invited. Three of them have confirmed that they'll be here this afternoon. The first session will start now and will end at 2:25. The next session will start right around 2:30. We'll have a five-minute break to set up for the next session. I'll moderate the first session, and Anita Shelburne, the editorial page editor for the Daily Progress, will moderate the State Senate Candidate Forum. Each candidate will have 3 minutes for an opening statement, 2 minutes to respond to questions, which will come from the audience. There are note cards, which you may have picked up on the way in, but we're going to have folks handing them out during the session. 2 minutes to respond, and there's some of the note cards right there with Madison. 2 minutes to respond to questions from the audience, which I will ask, and then 2 minutes for closing comments. We've flipped a coin, and Jim Hensley will start and with the first opening comment, and then he'll have the last closing comment, and Mr. Tracy will be second and then be first to close. We're going to have lights so that we keep them on schedule. As always, we're grateful to the center's help in giving us the rooms each time. It's going to be even better when they move to the center of Belvedere in the spring. There'll be more better parking, so you won't have to park in the overflow lot and walk up, but we're still very grateful. We welcome you to join the Senior Statesmen of Virginia and present any ideas that you have for programs. And again, you can use the cards and give them to me or anybody with a blue badge on for ideas. And if you're interested in being on the board, we're in the process now of thinking about the board for next year. So we'd love self-nominations. So if you have an interest in political, governmental, educational, or social issues that are important to seniors, I welcome your involvement with the next year's board. So based on the coin flip, I'm going to ask Jim Hensley to start with an opening comment for 3 minutes, please.
All right. Well, good afternoon. First off, I want to thank the Senior Statesmen of Virginia for organizing this forum. And I want to also thank all of you for coming out today. I think it might be helpful to start off by telling you why I'm in this race. This wasn't in my plans when I retired as public defender 3 years ago, thinking I'd spend more time with my wife, kids, and grandkids, some retirement. And I'm certainly not a politician. So here it is. What's happening in the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office has alarmed many people in our community. And I've become a candidate to make the case for changing the direction our criminal justice system is headed. Our community can and should end the outdated policies that have led to mass incarceration. We must have a fair and just system that works for everyone and not just a few. And victims of crime deserve an experienced advocate who can get the job done and can provide justice for our community. These are goals I can accomplish. I've handled thousands of criminal cases during the 43 years I've been a lawyer. I love the work I do, and I know the criminal justice system in and out. I started the Albemarle Public Defender's Office, and as head of that office for 18 years, I mentored lawyers and taught them how to try criminal cases. I have taught criminal law at the University of Virginia Law School for 20 years. I can prosecute cases in an organized and effective manner, and I can successfully prepare victims, police officers, and other witnesses for complicated trials. Unfortunately, during Robert Tracy's time in office, we've seen how inexperience can wreck a prosecution. Time is short here, so maybe I can talk more about that when we have questions. Right now, I want you to know more about me. I'm a really good lawyer. I have spent my life fighting for clients who've had the deck stacked against them. It's hard work, but I've been there for my clients every time. And believe me, I've helped to change a lot of lives. That's the kind of passion I'll bring to protecting our community. I'll be a tireless advocate for victims. I won't make rookie mistakes when it comes to prosecuting dangerous, violent criminals and removing them from the community. And for those others who justly deserve second chances, I will find ways to hold them accountable while helping them get back on their feet. When we do that, the risk of their reoffending goes down and our community is a safer place. This election gives voters a say in determining the future of our criminal justice system. Choose me and you will have a prosecutor who uses discretion wisely, a prosecutor whose approach to cases is shaped by common sense and experience.
No. He's working on it right now.
Okay.
Do you want to pull it closer, maybe?
Hello?
Try this one.
No.
This won't count against you.
I understand. Oh, that's working now.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you to the senior statesman for hosting this event and for everyone for being here. It is my honor to serve as your Commonwealth's attorney, and I'm running this time for the same reason I ran last time. It's because I love Albemarle County, and I think a functional legal system is absolutely essential to preserving public safety and providing people the dignity to live without fear in their own community. A little bit about my background. As you know, I was a graduate of the University of Illinois Law School, worked on Capitol Hill on the House Judiciary Committee, served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General, worked on bipartisan legislation in both institutions, came down here as a federal prosecutor, and ran for this office because I saw a clear injustice in the community. And I was given a 4-year term and had very specific priorities I wished to see enacted, and I'm proud to have a record that reflects those commitments. We created a diversionary docket for nonviolent offenders who have mental health issues. I see people who worked with me on that, including Albie LaFave and Shannon Neal, and I'm very proud of helping establish that nonviolent therapeutic docket to ensure that people with mental health conditions are given judicially supervised treatment rather than jail. Also expanded the number of people in the drug court, and I'm proud of that accomplishment as well. We also sought to ensure accountability for violent crime, and we have prioritized prosecutions for those who prey on the elderly in our community by establishing an elder abuse task force. I've presented here on multiple occasions, worked with Delegate Toscano on a bipartisan bill to enhance investigations and prosecutions of those offenses. We also have prioritized violent crime prosecutions by addressing violent crime where it occurs in our community without apology, by holding violent offenders accountable. We prosecuted MS-13 cases. We've done more sexual assault cases. We brought UVA into Title IX into our sexual assault response team before it was statutorily required. And we also have held accountable people who have been engaged in commercial sex trafficking, which is a problem in our community that we must face. Going forward, I will continue to place the law in the context it deserves to be as Commonwealth's attorney. A Commonwealth's attorney's authority is derived from his or her willingness to faithfully apply the law. That's what the oath of office means. And when a Commonwealth's attorney disregards that oath of office and assumes an ideological label and a non-prosecution mantra, like my opponent, public safety will suffer. I am in favor of accountability, but I'm also in favor of ensuring that we give nonviolent offenders treatment and recovery options, and also the right to return to society after they paid their dues to society with every chance of success. So with that, it has been my privilege to serve as your Commonwealth's attorney, and I look forward to answering the questions you might have.
So thank you. Perfect time to start the questions from the audience. The first question, and I'll start with Mr. Tracy since he went last. The first question is, the country has grown weary from all the gun violence. So far this year, there's been more mass shootings than days. Earlier this summer, one in Virginia Beach. What are your ideas for controlling gun violence? And what about universal background checks, red flag laws, and any other issues that might control some of the gun violence?
I think the governor said it well when he said we must never become inured to mass shootings in this country, and I completely share that sentiment. The Second Amendment is a personal right. The Supreme Court has held clearly that it's a personal right. So limitations on the Second Amendment must respect that individual right and individual liberty. And as a constitutional officer and a law enforcement officer, we have an obligation to uphold the Constitution and all of its provisions, including the Second Amendment. With respect to some of these laws that have been recommended, I know there's a law in Congress that is gaining some support. There is an increasing awareness that we can and should do more to ensure that people who may pose a threat to public safety are separated in a timely fashion from that risk that might be presented to society. And it's important to ensure that any law in any proposal respect the due process rights of citizens. Those laws, some of which would summarily separate someone from personal property and infringe on a basic constitutional right, lack due process. And we must be vigilant to ensure that we respect due process rights and take steps necessary to protect public safety.
Thank you. Mr. Hensley.
Well, thank you. There were three parts to the question. What are my views on gun violence? And I think that as a candidate for prosecutor, the most important response that a prosecutor can have to gun violence is to be an effective prosecutor and prosecute people who have been charged with gun crimes. That's the primary responsibility of the prosecutor and the prosecutor's office. And I have the experience to be able to do that effectively, and I will do that effectively. Now, the other two issues that were raised in the question have to do with proposed legislation. So with respect to proposed legislation, that is more of an advisory view that I might be able to give. That is not central to the office of the prosecutor. So with respect to the two items, the universal background checks and the red flag laws, I agree entirely with Mr. Tracy that any new legislation has to incorporate due process protections. That's fundamental to our Constitution, and I certainly support that. Now, red flag laws, I support red flag laws as a matter of policy. That's my view. That's not an official position that prosecutors, it's not an official part of a prosecutor's duty, but here we are, we're politicians, and so let's talk about what our views are. I support red flag laws. I also support universal background check legislation. I think it's long overdue, and I hope that the people in our state and local governments can get together and really do something significant to prevent gun violence.
Thank you. And this will be for Mr. Hensley first. And question is, the image from the illegal torch march on the Friday night before the Unite for Rights rally down the lawn and the assault of UVA faculty, students, and community members protecting the statue of Thomas Jefferson on the evening of August 11th seared in the mind of the citizens. And so the question for both of you is, if you were, since I'm starting with Mr. Hensley, if you were prosecutor at the time, would you have handled the prosecution of some of the folks on the Friday night differently than Mr. Tracy did? And then when I get to Mr. Tracy, as you look back, what would you have done differently? So, Mr. Hensley.
All right, thank you. I mean, our whole community was torn apart by the things that happened here on August 11th and August 12th. Now, what happened at the university on August 11th was torch-wielding terrorists who came to the university and terrorized people in this community, students, faculty. And the University of Virginia is in the jurisdiction of Albemarle County. So the question is presented, what do you do to respond to that terrorist incident? So I only know what has been reported in the news media, but I think we can draw some conclusions from that information. And the conclusion that I would draw is that there was sufficient evidence of committing a crime to justify a prosecution. And I'm not saying how the prosecution would have come out, because I don't have all the facts. And, of course, that's why you go to court. You bring a charge, and you go to court to find out what the court believes is an appropriate and just outcome. So I believe that there is sufficient evidence on the face of it to have brought charges. Now, Mr. Tracy disagrees, and he says not only is there insufficient evidence to bring charges, but he goes to such an extreme that he says he would be ethically prohibited from bringing charges. I totally disagree with that, and other criminal law experts in our community disagree with that. Look at Dave Chapman's memorandum, which is in the public record, saying that a prosecution would be on firm ground. Look at Ann Coughlin, the University of Virginia Law School criminal law professor, to the same extent. So, yes, I think there's sufficient evidence to move forward with the case, and I certainly back then, if I had been prosecutor, would have done that.
Thank you. What would you have done differently looking back?
Well, I appreciate my opponent acknowledging that he doesn't have the facts necessary, so it's sort of inconsistent to say he would have gone forward acknowledging the fact that he doesn't have the facts necessary to establish probable cause. I fundamentally disagree with him, and this reflects his lack of prosecution experience of any kind, that you should indict a case to see what happened. And he said words to that effect, and that ought to concern everyone in this room. When a prosecutor brings a case, he or she must have probable cause. And the special rules of a prosecutor in 3.8 of the Rules of Professional Responsibility establish that bright line rule. And the model rules of professional responsibility in the ABA rules say not only probable cause, but proof at all stages beyond a reasonable doubt. He just acknowledged that as a prosecutor, he would indict cases to see what criminal conduct had occurred. That's inconsistent with the rules of professional responsibility. I share the abhorrence of everybody who saw that hate in the county. There were three torch marches, one in May, one in August, and one in October 2017. It's important to recognize that Tim Hafey, who wrote the independent investigation report, who's now the UVA general counsel, on pages 174 and 175, recommended changing the statute to encompass an open flame and to make sure that the intent standard was lower. He wouldn't have been wasting his ink in that report if he didn't see a problem with that statute. That's important to recognize. Second, David Toscano introduced a bill to codify that change, further confirming deficiencies of the statute. Prosecutor has to have the courage and confidence to prosecute cases without regard to identity and with regard to the conduct in question. It's a fundamental difference between me and my opponent in this race. It's important to keep that in mind in all cases. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt, probable cause to indict, irrespective of the identity of defendants. Thank you.
So let me go to a very short question, and it's a function of what your background. Question for, I'm going to start with Mr. Tracy first. When did you establish residence in Alma County, and are you eligible to vote? And Mr. Hens will answer the same question.
I established jurisdiction or residency in Albemarle in 2008, I believe. I was in D.C. I'm here because my wife did her surgical training at UVA and finished her fellowship here, and that's why I'm here. I'm here to support her and my family. So, yes, I'm absolutely eligible to vote in this race for Commonwealth's attorney.
Thank you. I moved to Albemarle County in 1971. I lived out by Stone Robinson Elementary School, and I moved here after I'd been a high school teacher for 2 years, and I was in the VISTA program. And by the way, 1971, I think, was before Mr. Tracy was born. While I had been a public high school teacher under the Volunteers in Service to America program, I went to vocational school at night, and I became a welder. And I worked in Albemarle County for 2 years as a welder. I worked in Albemarle County factories. Those factories are no longer here. Building Systems, which was located out near Wegmans, and Chemtron, which was located out on Old Ivy Road. So the beginnings of my contact with this community date to 1971. Over the years, I've been a lawyer here. I went to the University of Virginia Law School, and I've been a lawyer and practiced in the Albemarle court system, which is where the prosecutor does his or her work for 34 years. That's my connection to the community. I presently live in the city. I do not live in the county. And the law allows that I can live in the city while running for this office. And the two prosecutors before Mr. Tracy similarly lived in the city at the time of their election, Denise Lunsford, and before her, Jim Camblos.
Thank you.
So I think he didn't answer whether he's eligible to vote.
I said I live in the city, and I think it's understood that if you live in the city, you're not eligible to vote in the county.
Just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you. And starting with Mr. Hensley, the first question for you now is define the difference between upholding the law and promoting social justice, and Mr. Tracy will answer after you do.
Well, there is no difference between upholding the law and promoting social justice, because upholding the law is the job that a prosecutor has to promote justice. Now, you use the term social justice. We can use different terms, but I think the heart of the matter is the prosecutor's job is to promote justice. And so I get a lot of criticism from Mr. Tracy for being somebody who disregards the law because I have an ideological label attached to my name. And the ideological label that he refers to most often is progressive. So does that mean that I'd be interested in specific examples where I disregard the law? I don't believe that I've ever said that, nor do I intend to disregard the law. I think in terms of this question, what the prosecutor needs to do is regard the law and all of the options that are in the law to promote justice in the community. And the big thing that the prosecutor has is prosecutorial discretion. Prosecutors make decisions all the time, and they make decisions to promote justice. Let me give you a quick example because time's running out here. You might have somebody who's shoplifted a couple of times, and they come in with stealing a candy bar. It's the third time, and that requires that. That is a charge which could require a felony charge. Now, the prosecutor has a decision. The prosecutor is not required by law, is not required to uphold the law to charge that person with a felony offense. That person could be charged in the discretion of the prosecutor with a lesser offense. And that's what I mean by promoting justice and using prosecutorial discretion for that purpose.
Three quick points. I didn't refer to my opponent as a progressive prosecutor. He refers to himself as a progressive prosecutor on his webpage and social media. I think it's important to recognize that any ideological label defining a prosecutor undermines equal justice under law and the idea that everyone should get a fair shake in court. And it's also very disrespectful to victims of crime. You asked about what crime that you might not prosecute. You were on WINA, and you said malicious wounding was often too punitive. It's a 5 to 20-year statutory range for injuring, disfiguring, maiming, or threatening to kill someone. And I think it's an appropriate sanction to have a significant punishment like that, at least the possibility. My opponent thought those cases should resolve as simple assault and battery. I think that's a mistake, and I do think that undermines the law. Because prosecutorial discretion is kind of like using a company credit card. You get to use it sometimes when there are exceptional circumstances. But when you abuse that discretion, when you use it without regard to the General Assembly and you substitute your will for that of the General Assembly, you're undermining the separation of powers and you are embezzling the credibility of the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office and the law enforcement community that the Commonwealth's Attorney serves.
May I have
I'm sorry. I've got some time left. And you heard it from my opponent. Social justice is the same as enforcing the law. It's, you know, have some humility to recognize the prosecutor movement, the progressive prosecutor movement, is just as inappropriate as a conservative prosecutor movement. And what would people in this room think if there were a movement of conservative prosecutors who said, with regard to this law, this type of offense, and this type of offense, I'm going to disregard the General Assembly as a matter of course? That's not discretion. That's statutory nullification.
And may I have...
As a moderator, I have the option of giving each candidate another 1 minute to respond, and then I have the next question after that. Yeah. So 1 minute.
Thank you. With respect to the comment about malicious wounding, I never said that I wouldn't prosecute malicious wounding, and this goes to what I said in my first part of this answer. I don't want to disregard the law, but I want to look at the law in all its complexity. I've handled literally hundreds of malicious wounding cases, and I know that when you see it come in the door and charged as malicious wounding, it is not necessarily going to be a malicious wounding case. There are different grades of the offenses, and Mr. Tracy mentioned one of them, which is assault and battery. I've been to juries. I've been to courts. I want to look at those sorts of cases, as I would look at all cases, to see where the case ought to land in the interest of justice. And just because it's charged one way doesn't mean that it doesn't end up another way, and that's why a prosecutor has to look at it very carefully. So I want to clarify that with respect to what was said about my attitude on that.
Mr. Tracy, 1 minute.
Those were his words. As I said, I think the authority, think about it from a civics perspective, separation of powers. Judicial branch and executive officers take an oath to support our laws and Constitution, and that's the legislator, the legislative body, telling the other branches who are equal and co-equal, your obligation is to enforce our law. And in the Federalist Papers, there is a discussion. Madison talks about the legislative power in its general applicability. That's why the legislative process is difficult. It's bicameral, legislative, parliamentary. I understand how the process works. It's deliberately and intentionally complex because those laws apply to everyone. It is inconsistent with our form of government for a prosecutor to summarily disregard the General Assembly. That's not how our system works. And those separations of powers are a bulwark against tyranny, and violating them is an invitation to that kind of disorder and that kind of substitution of the legislative will for that of the individual prosecutor.
So let me follow up that the last two comments, and that is, and starting with Mr. Tracy first, do you see or have you experienced times where you have not prosecuted when it appears that a crime had been committed?
Absolutely.
And
we do
so.
This therapeutic mental health docket, people enter a plea, and if they finish supervised mental health training, that charge is either reduced or dismissed. Same with drug court. There are circumstances that may be exceptional in presented cases where there's a problem with the search or something else requiring an additional consideration of the charge. There are circumstances where cases are improperly charged by a law enforcement officer, and we make provision with that. With that approach comes recognition that we have an obligation to faithfully apply the law, utilize that discretion in a disciplined manner, and not substitute our will for that of the General Assembly. We utilize discretion all the time. But my opponent, as a matter of policy, as a progressive prosecutor, embraces the role of saying, I am a transformative agent, and that's a role for the legislative branch, not one constitutional officer.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Tracy just said it. Absolutely, he does not prosecute some of the time. That's what I'm talking about. It's the decision-making process. When do you decide to prosecute, or when do you decide to reduce a charge, or when do you decide not to prosecute at all because there are circumstances? And he also gave another circumstance that prosecutors need to look at when a case comes in, and that's it might be improperly charged. So that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that because I am a progressive and call myself a progressive that I'm going to disregard the law. I'm going to intelligently look at the case cases when they come in and decide whether they should be prosecuted, what reasons there might be for not prosecuting, or whether they've been properly charged, or whether the evidence, even if it's properly charged, whether the evidence at the end of the day is going to be sufficient to gain a conviction. So I do intend to look at cases in a disciplined way, and I agree with Mr. Tracy that prosecutors need to be disciplined, but my discipline is informed by my values. And that's what I mean by being a progressive prosecutor. My values come into that process.
Thank you. Mr. Hensley, that you get to answer this question first. It's well known that our country incarcerates more people per capita than any democracy that we would care to compare ourselves to. Within the U.S., Virginia ranks 16th highest in per capita incarceration, but fourth lowest in the rates of violent crime. What are your thoughts about the impact, good or bad, of all this incarceration in this country and for our state?
Well, I think the impact is bad. This is a term that I used when I spoke earlier, mass incarceration. We are in the era where we are still in Albemarle County following the policies of mass incarceration that are outdated. They come back from the 80s and 90s. So what does mass incarceration mean? It means exactly what you just said. We keep people in jail who shouldn't be in jail, and we keep people who might be able to be in jail for a lot longer than they should be. So what can we do about it? I think that we need to keep people in the community to the extent that that's possible. And I think my experience as a public defender with the people who come in contact with the criminal justice system gives me the experience to identify opportunities to do things differently. And when I say keep people in the community, I mean, number one, they don't walk out of the courthouse door when the case is over. They walk out into the community under intensive supervision so we can keep track of what's going on with them. Then number two, they're going to, while they're in the community, get help. We know that substantial drivers of criminal behavior are substance abuse and mental illness. So let's get them help and treatment for those issues. We know there are other things that are driving criminal behavior, poverty, lack of opportunity, family problems. We can address those issues that are leading to criminal behavior by giving help and support to these people in the community. And what we get back as a community when we do this is, number one, people who are treated that way are less likely to reoffend, and that means we have a safer community. Number two, there's a substantial racial component to the mass incarceration. And so if we can reduce or eliminate mass incarceration, we're going to make steps toward achieving racial justice. And number three, the community gets a big dividend in the savings of money that we're wasting on jails and prisons right now. That can be reinvested in the community.
Tracy.
With respect to substance abuse and mental health issues driving criminal conduct, we have acknowledged that, and I was proud to play a leadership role in establishing a therapeutic mental health docket for the first time in Central Virginia, and I've expanded the number of people in our drug court to near parity with the city of Charlottesville. It used to be about 30%. It's now about 50%, and that is identifying people who benefit from treatment rather than jail, and that's something that I'm committed to and will continue to be supportive of. If you look at the bookings data over the last several years at the ACRJ, the city of Charlottesville has a smaller population than the county of Albemarle, less than half, and their booking volume per capita is higher. It's higher, and it reflects underlying activity, and we can't disregard that. It's important to look at crime not as a generic statistic, but as a recognition that behind every crime is a victim who deserves accountability and a fair shot at justice. And it's important that this discussion be driven by statistics and not slogans, facts, not fiction. And it's so important that we all take a holistic approach to understanding what are the causes of criminal misconduct, but not being so lacking in compassion that we fail to hold people accountable for criminal misconduct when it occurs. Law enforcement is sort of like the first responder. It's like the emergency room at the University of Virginia. They get priority one calls for service and they respond. The emergency division does the same thing. We have to respond to those calls for service. We have to respond to those bookings. We have to ensure justice and accountability in our community and make sure that we apply the law fairly and without bias. That's what equal justice under law means.
Thank you. So this is a question for both of you, but it keys in on something you've already talked about, Mr. Tracy, and that is, what is your commitment to other alternatives to incarceration? And you talked about the mental health and drug court. And I guess to expand on this question a little bit, is there a need to change the law to allow you to move more into the drug court than 50%? And how about mental health? So.
Well, it wouldn't require legal change. We've been making that progress with respect to drug court in terms of enhancing the percentage of Albemarle participants. The therapeutic jocket, one important part of my support, and Albie would know and other people, Liz Murtaugh, who is the public defender in the audience as well, hired by my opponent while she was before she became public defender. It's important to recognize that that program was supported by me only after we received authorization and approval from the Virginia Supreme Court. I didn't think it was sufficient to sort of ad hoc that approach without that kind of legal approval. That was very important to me. We also had support from Herb Stewart, and I helped bring him into the discussion. He is married to Dr. Herb Stewart. He's a Western State psychologist married to Liz Palmer on the Board of Supervisors. It represented a bipartisan approach to addressing needs in our community. So the General Assembly could and do more to enhance funding for these sorts of alternative dockets. We have a good population of people in our drug court. We're expanding the number in the therapeutic docket. We are, in some cases, changing or modifying or mending felony charges, particularly if they're larceny charges, petty larceny third or higher, to permit people who are nonviolent from entering these therapeutic programs. And before I agreed to play a role in the process, I consulted with my law enforcement partners, because it's important to realize, and we haven't heard this yet, the Commonwealth's attorney is part of the law enforcement jurisdiction body in whatever jurisdiction he or she is elected, and that's in the Virginia Code. And they support some of these non-punitive dockets because an increasing volume of calls for service come from a very small percentage of the population who would benefit from this kind of treatment. So I would support expanding those efforts and for the General Assembly to provide more funding to make additional participation possible.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Tracy just said again that he would amend felony charges in order to allow people to participate. That's exactly the kind of thing that I'm talking about here today, and I've talked about before. Prosecutor needs to use discretion to provide for just outcomes to the cases that come in front of the prosecutor. Now, with respect to the therapeutic docket, I acknowledge that Mr. Tracy was a leader in establishing that docket, and give him credit for that. That's a good thing to do. And as he indicated, it's a big community collaboration that went into that. This process started in April of 2015 and went forward from then, and Mr. Tracy came on board in 2016. And so, but you have to realize these sorts of alternatives come about because of community collaboration, and a lot of people play a part in this, including in this case the Public Defender Office, beginning when I was the Public Defender. Now, do we need more than a therapeutic docket and a drug court? Yes, we do. The information from the last fiscal year is that Albemarle County has currently seven participants in the therapeutic docket, and there were five people who were successful, and so they've graduated and gone on, and good for them. That's great. But the program is very small. So my point in being interested in increasing resources that this community has to offer to keep people in the community instead of wasting time on wasting their community's time and money on excessive incarceration is that as a criminal justice system leader, I will continue to participate in those community collaborations that will generate more resources, more programs, things that we can reach out and help more than the 12 people who've been in the therapeutic docket from Albemarle County.
The next question, and I'm sure that you've had a chance to look.
Can I comment just briefly on the number? Our participation rate is about what the city's is. And the reason that is we have a high-risk model for participation in that therapeutic docket. Low-risk people are not qualified for entry according to its rules because we're trying to help people who present with high needs. And with those high needs come a higher failure rate. So as we all discussed, you weren't part of those discussions, we wouldn't be surprised and shouldn't be surprised that a lot of people would not succeed. That's a reflection of how difficult it is to get into the program, not the overall quality of it.
Can you talk a little bit about, and you both have a chance to respond, can you talk a little bit of how you determine whether somebody's high risk or low risk?
That, fortunately, and that was one of the reasons I asked Dr. Stewart to participate, is a judgment call of the therapeutic docket team, mental health professionals, Region 10, OAR, people who are qualified to make mental health decisions. I certainly don't assume that authority or responsibility or knowledge.
Mr. Hensley, do you want to talk about high risk and low risk and what role that plays?
And we do have instruments for measuring risk. But this is the point, and I think Mr. Tracy has made it. This program is targeted to a specific population, a population of high-risk individuals. And this is a population that, as he says, generates a very small number of participants. The figures that I gave you were the figures that I got from the OAR head who compiles those statistics. So, but that isn't the end of it. The point is, we can do more. So why don't we have a program that targets low-risk people? Why don't we have other programs that can be successful in addressing criminal behavior in our community and keeping people from having to be sent away to jail for excessive sentences? So, yes, this is a good program, but let's do more, and that's what I would do if I were elected as Commonwealth's attorney.
Thank you. Mr. Tracy, it's reported here that you asked the Board of Supervisors a month ago for additional $100,000 for staff to prosecute more cases. Can you talk about what you see as the needs for your office?
I don't know upon what you're relying that question.
Let me generalize.
If the person is in the audience who asked that question, I'd be very curious.
Well, let me generalize it. What changes would you like to see in your staffing and or the funding for the Commonwealth Attorney?
Yeah, I would like to know the source of that because that we have made no formal request for $100,000 of anything from the Board of Supervisors. What we have seen over the last few years is an actual reduction in the expenditure to that office, and I'm proud of that because I consider myself a steward of taxpayer funds, and I'm pleased that the taxpayers of Albemarle County support that office, not the Board of Supervisors. They don't write those checks out of their own pocket. It's everyone in this room who helps support our office. And we do get a supplement from the county, which permits us to hire people from other parts of the Commonwealth to work in that office. And I'm proud of some of the people that we've attracted and retained as a result. So we have actually saved money over the last few years. And it's important to recognize that with respect to the Board of Supervisors, some people, while we've undertaken more cases, so that's something to keep in mind, that the Board of Supervisors sometimes doesn't understand. I won't say this about everyone, but some of them sometimes lose understanding. I think Rick Randolph is the outgoing Scottsville member who thought that, you know, because that supplement was provided, that it was sort of like the appropriate appropriations authority of Congress, that they could start making demands of the office, like do this and do that. It is a separate constitutional office under Virginia law for a reason. That's to protect the office from being susceptible to precisely that type of political pressure. I see another constitutional officer, former constitutional officer here, Sheriff Ed Robb, thank you for being here. He understands that. It's got to be a separate office, bringing cases consistent with the law without regard to politics and certainly without regard to political pressure from the Board of Supervisors.
Mr. Hendler, the question is generalized, and that is, what changes would you like to see in the office?
Well, I would like to see the office be able to prosecute effectively. Take, for example, the Jason Kessler case, where Mr. Tracy brought a perjury charge against Jason Kessler, who was one of the organizers of the Unite the Right rally. And And in the process of trying that case, declined to or forgot to or made a mistake of not proving that the crime occurred in Albemarle County. As a result, the case was lost, and the victim of that crime did not get justice, and the community did not get justice. So the most important priority that I see is improving the quality of the prosecution in the prosecutor's office, and that's an example. And I would add that Mr. Tracy is incapable of learning from the mistake that he made in that very serious case, because he has said that it was not a mistake. The mistake belonged to Judge Cheryl Higgins, who was the one who ruled against him. So I think that we need a change in the prosecutor's office in order to have effective and competent prosecution in Albemarle County. Now, beyond that, I think we need to have an office that shares the values that I have and the values that I believe this community has. And that's why this is an elected office, because this is a chance for the community to decide whether we want to continue the outdated policies of mass incarceration or whether we want to make a change that can bring about a safer community and can bring about saving money from excessive incarceration that we're now seeing now. So,
Mr. Tracy, since you were directly mentioned in Mr. Hensley's response, let me give you 30 seconds to respond to what...
30 seconds. Okay.
32.
Okay. You know, this is a January 2017 event on the downtown mall in Charlottesville, Virginia. Consulting with law enforcement, waiting for evidence from the state lab, brought this case in the county of Albemarle. Perjury. There was a person here who was accused of utilizing force without justification here. The charge against that individual was dismissed with prejudice in the city. As I think my opponent knows, perjury affects an individual. It also has a victim as the Commonwealth of Virginia, because it's a crime against the state in terms of not telling the truth before a panel. I disagreed with the court's decision in that case. Courts routinely reopen matters if there's any reason to clarify, sometimes on their own motion. The court did not do so in that case. It's important to recognize, and I don't make a habit of criticizing the circuit court, and I'm not going to start now. The court has that decision making. Scott Goodman, defense lawyer, maybe with as much experience as my opponent, said another court could have found otherwise. But it's important to recognize in this context, it happened in January 2017, and that we prosecute conduct, not identity. That's something that my opponent doesn't seem to understand.
Okay. Let me end for the last question. The last question is, what is your position as far as notifying ICE of somebody that you've decided to prosecute?
Who's first on this?
I think you're...
I am? Okay. ICE notification, this comes up a lot. I believe that ICE should be notified according to the law. There's a law that says when somebody's booked into the jail, ICE gets notified. And so the issue that has been created in this debate and in the prosecutor's race this time is, what about another separate voluntary notification that occurs at the time somebody's being released? That voluntary notification is a matter of jail board policy. The prosecutor does not sit on the jail board. The prosecutor does not have a say in the determination of that policy. Now, of course, the prosecutor can advise, and Mr. Tracy does that. And Mr. Tracy says, we think that the jail board, the jail staff, needs to do the job that ICE has to do. They need to help ICE out, as if ICE doesn't have enough resources to get the job done. I say, and I spoke out as a citizen in January of 2018, I spoke out at the jail board, I say ICE should do its job. ICE should get the notice, which is required by law, and if they identify somebody in the jail who is a target of their interest, then it's up to them to take the appropriate steps to get that person get a warrant, a judicially issued warrant, or whatever steps it takes to get that person within the ICE jurisdiction. And they're not doing that because the federal government, they just want to do it the easy way. They want to pass down one more responsibility to the locality. And I disagree with that. But remember, what we're talking about here is a matter of policy, not a matter of law.
Thank you. Mr. Tree.
My opponent is correct. It has generated considerable public attention, and I see several people who showed up to weigh in on that issue in the audience today. I was asked by Diantha McKeel, who was the chair of the board at the time and also a member of the Board of Supervisors, my opinion on the issue. So was a Commonwealth attorney from Nelson County, and the sheriff is on the board. And five of the six law enforcement officers who weighed in took my position, which is supporting continued notification. That was Sheriff Harding, who's endorsed me for this race, the sheriff in Nelson, the Commonwealth attorney in Nelson, Sheriff Brown from the city of Charlottesville, very importantly, and the U.S. attorney in Roanoke. Now, immigration authority is vested in the federal branch, in the federal agency. And it's important to not try to subvert or undermine the lawful exercise and application of the immigration laws. Congress has provided ICE authority to request detainers of non-citizens who are subject to priority deportation review. These are administrative warrants that permit a facility to hold someone pending a notification to ICE. It's important to recognize that our jail does not hold any non-citizen a day past their state charges. All this does is to say, because ICE is not in the jails, and there are very few removal agents in this jurisdiction, before you release someone wanted for detention and wanted for priority deportation hearings, give us some notice. We have seen the catastrophic public safety consequences when that doesn't occur in other jurisdictions. It's important to not be selective about what federal law we uphold. This part of the country has had a very unfortunate history of being selective about federal law. And it's important that we apply the law fairly and that we not subvert the law as the proponents of ending notification openly advocated at those board meetings. That was the message that was communicated at those board meetings. Very important to me as a first-generation American whose parents are both immigrants to this country that there be a lawful distinction between illegal and non-legal immigration. It's a very important point none of us should forget.
Mr. Tracy, since you went last with the opening comments, you start with the closing comments. 2 minutes, please.
Well, I think there are some fundamental differences between my opponent and me. Some of them were made clear today. Indicting cases to find out what happened. That is a dangerous statement from someone seeking the office of Commonwealth's attorney. The understanding that I am a legal advocate, not a social justice advocate, as my opponent described himself. That I am a law enforcement officer, not a legislator or someone else who substitutes his judgment for that of the General Assembly. And the experience I've had as a prosecutor in state and federal court that my opponent completely lacks. It is important also to understand that my opponent has received direct contributions from individuals who have spent unprecedented sums of money in this race. $50,000 individual contribution from one. I see other members of the defense bar who've written $5,500 checks. I represent everyone in this room. I do not and will not place the office up for sale to any individual contributor or anybody else. It is important that I uphold my oath of office to faithfully and impartially apply the law without bias. Finally, it is extraordinarily important to emphasize that the progressive prosecutor movement is a recent development in American jurisprudence and American law only because for most of our history, people reflexively and intuitively understood how unfair and how inconsistent with our structure of government it is for a prosecutor to associate himself with a partisan ideological label. It's inconsistent with the role of a prosecutor, undermines public safety, undermines confidence in the fair administration of justice, and is inconsistent with what the oath of office confers, the authority to apply the law fairly without bias to obtain equal justice under the law.
Thank you, Mr. Hensley.
Thank you. Well, you just heard Mr. Tracy say that I have a partisan ideological label and then I'm political, but he's not. Well, let me tell you, he's running as a Republican, and in 2015 he ran as a Republican. Now, we know from this race for sheriff that you can run as an independent if you want, but he chooses to run as a Republican. So is he non-political, a non-political Republican? What's in it for him as a Republican? Well, I'll tell you one thing that's in it for him. He'd been in office for less than 15 months when he asked Donald Trump to appoint him to a position in the Trump administration, a position that would take him away from Albemarle County, a position that tells you what he's really interested in as being prosecutor here. He's interested in using the citizens of Albemarle County as a stepping stone to some other office. And do you think for a minute that Donald Trump would have considered him for that job if he said, look, I'm not a Republican prosecutor, I'm a non-political prosecutor? Of course not. He's in this for politics. And don't accuse me of being a partisan because I express progressive values. Values are what this election is all about. That's why you have a vote. Vote for these values that reflect what the community wants to see in its criminal justice system. Now, money. Yes, I've gotten some big contributions, and so has he. He got a $10,000 contribution from Richard Baxter Gillum, who gives only to Republicans. Again, is it because he's non-political, or is it because he's a Republican? So let's put to rest this idea that calling yourself a progressive and expressing values about what you want to see in the criminal justice system is political. It's not. So he's also said that he will use discretion. He said it over and over again, and that's what I'm saying. So it's not being a prosecutor is not an automatic mechanical process. It's applying your values to the situations that are presented in the office and working in the interest of justice for the whole community, and that's what I would do.
So I've decided to quit. I've decided to give Mr. Tracy and Mr. Hensley another 30 seconds because the closing statement ended up making charges. So let me...
It was a very direct political charge accusing me of utilizing this office for additional public office. I'm very happy here. I'm here with my wife, supporting her career and our family and my young daughter and her schedule, and I make no apology for that whatsoever. I'm very proud of it. The National Sheriff's Association, Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, supported me for that position. They asked me to consider it. I, as I said at the time, am happy here and continue to be happy here. So I would expect going forward that you get the facts straight before you make personal allegations like that. I continue.
Yeah.
I seek public office again for the same reason, to uphold the law, to provide dignity, and to be a voice and compassionate voice to victims of crime. Thank you very much.
Mr. Hensley, 30 seconds.
Okay. Well, this question was premised on making charges, and it sounded like Mr. Tracy was the one who got charged. Did you not hear him say that I sold my office for a campaign contribution? That's a charge. And I do not sell this office for a campaign contribution. I have integrity, and this community knows that I have integrity. So we're talking about charges back and forth here.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I want to, if you give everybody a thank you for coming.
Thanks,
very much appreciate it. We're going to take a 5-minute break to set up for the state senator candidate. Welcome back to the second of the candidate forums of today. It's my pleasure to introduce the moderator for this session, which is Anita Shelburne, who is the editorial page editor for the Daily Progress. Anita?
Thank you. Well, again, thanks for being here. Thank you to the candidates. We look forward to a spirited but civil debate. And I believe the rules are each candidate gets 3 minutes for an opening statement. There has been a coin flip to determine who goes first. And then that order will be reversed towards the end when each candidate gets 2 minutes for a closing statement. So the order is Ms. Laufer, Mr. Harding, and Mr. Deeds. So if you would take it away.
Is this, what is that? Hi, everybody. My name is Amy Laufer, and I'm the Democratic candidate for Senate District 17, which includes Eastern Albemarle all the way out to Fredericksburg. I first want to say thank you all for being here on an afternoon, and I really appreciate it, and I appreciate the senior statesman for putting this together and the senior center for hosting us. Many times I've been here for these debates, and I've been sitting in the audience, so I'm really honored to be a candidate this year. I grew up on a dairy farm in Wisconsin. I am one of eight children, and in order for our farm to survive, each one of us kids had to work, picking stones, baling hay, and milking and feeding the cows, as well as getting good grades, and then when we were old enough, actually having a paying job. I'm proud to say that I am first-generation college graduate. It took me nearly 6 years to do it because I paid for it myself, including lots of different jobs and packing fish in Alaska for 3 summers to do it. And I say that because I'm telling you, I'm very persistent. After college, I wanted to serve our country. I went into the Peace Corps, and I was stationed outside of Kingston, Jamaica at an elementary school. And it was there that I really fell in love with education. And I can tell you, education is the foundation to a healthy society. I came back and I got a master's in education. And my first job in Virginia was teaching middle school math and science in Louisa County. I taught middle school for several years until our second child was born. And he was born with a rare medical condition. I had to make the difficult decision to stop teaching and take care of him, which has been amazing. Actually, his birthday yesterday, he's 14. But while I was staying home, somebody asked me to run for the school board. I ran for the school board. I served for 7 years on the Charlottesville School Board. I was both vice chair and chair. We had a lot of challenges, a lot of accomplishments, the highest graduation rate in our city's history. But I can tell you from my time on school board, it's really important who we elect. Elected officials make decisions that impact our everyday life, and I'm on the ballot this year because I want to have a better voice in Richmond. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Mr. Deeds? Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Harding?
It's all right. Make sure this is working. Awesome. Thank you, Anita. Thank you, the senior statesman. Thank you, the center, for hosting these forums. It's very important for folks to be able to get out and hear these debates, the contrast of ideas, and, of course, the audience for coming out on in the middle of a weekday to hear from us. I'm running for office primarily because I've been watching the political climate for a very long time, and it seems as though in Richmond and, of course, Washington, D.C., but in Richmond as well, getting things done no longer seems to matter to those in office. I've noticed that they've pit us against each other, whether it be through political theater, purely partisan rhetoric, issues that both parties, both sides of the aisle realize aren't going to get solved on the floor, but they feed it into their bases in order to put people against each other. And ultimately, they do pit us against each other. So I'm running as an independent in this race. And that required me to go out and knock doors and talk to folks at the polls and primary day and talk to people in their neighborhoods to get the signatures of registered voters in the 25th district to be able to run for this office. I believe that civic discourse has fallen apart. I believe that people have turned off their ears and their minds to thinking about critical thought on the issues. It just becomes red team, blue team, right team, left team, instead of actually what matters to your neighbor, what matters to the 25th district. And that climate serves party stranglehold on the system. It serves the corporate donors down in Richmond that peddle cash and peddle campaign donations to both sides. If you look at some of the largest corporate donors, they peddle it to both parties equally, to the detriment of the people and to the detriment of our constituents. You've noticed the special interest groups can increase their power as the government grows because what they're buying becomes more influential. And ultimately, it favors career politicians who are able to build an entire career on this type of division. And so I'm running to try to eliminate that distraction, fight against it, because it's to the detriment of our civil liberties, to equal opportunities, to equal justice, and to an even playing field. There's an entire class of folks who've been underserved, several classes of folks, I should say, that have been underserved by this increasing hyperpartisan, hyperbolic, and destructive climate. And it's been building and building and building, and ultimately I'm running because I think enough is enough. I'm born and raised here in Charlottesville in Albemarle. I'll be here for the rest of my life. I've lived in about 80% of the district all of my life. I went to the University of Virginia and Washington and Lee for law school, and the places I haven't lived, I have extensive family who have a great perspective as well. This is the birthplace of American independence, and I think it's time that Virginia can take a lead and put an independent into the state Senate, into a very volatile 50-50 split, throw a independent in there to be a leverage between both parties, break that stranglehold, and ultimately leverage it on behalf of the people. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Deeds?
Thank you very much, Anita. And I would thank the senior center and thank you all for being here. Thank the other folks on the podium with me. You know, I've been in the Senate for 18 years. It's been the honor of my life to serve in the General Assembly. Think about it this way. 400 years ago, July 30, 1619, the General Assembly of Virginia, the House of Burgesses, met for the first time. That ought to burn something on the heart of every single one of us who call ourselves Virginians. 400 years ago, when we're still meeting, first legislative body in the Western Hemisphere, what happens in the other 49 states and in Washington is modeled after what happened here first. We still do it best. You know, and we're still doing it. Other people are modeled after what we're doing, and we're still using basically the same procedure. It gives me great honor to think that in those curved steps of our Capitol, giants, and some not so giants, but a lot of people walked in those curvatures. They spent $205 million about 20 years ago remodeling the Capitol, but they couldn't take the footprints out of those marble steps. And it's very cool. I'm proud that I've been part of being able to get things done. We've had our disagreements, but you know, the last few years we were able to expand Medicaid, and that gave health care to more than 400,000 people, ultimately to more than 400,000 Virginians already in the first 9 months, to more than 320,000 Virginians, 30,000 of whom have accessed mental health services already through Medicaid expansion. I'm proud that we were able to raise teacher pay by 5%, the highest teacher pay increase in more than 10 years. Is it enough? No, it's not enough. But education has to remain our top priority if we are really going to be a Commonwealth of opportunity, if we're going to create opportunity in every corner of the Commonwealth. And I'm very proud of the work that goes on to rebuild our system of mental health care. You know, my goal the last few years has been to make sure that people that have need for services, when they have a mental illness, they have access to those services wherever they are in the Commonwealth of Virginia. We have a long way to go. We have a system of 40 community service boards and 10 mental health hospitals. It's been my goal the last few years to put together that system into a unit of cohesion where we can efficiently and effectively serve the Commonwealth of Virginia. We still have a lot of work to do. We're in the middle of that work right now. I'm asking for your vote to return, but today I'm looking forward to your questions.
Thank you. And it is time for the question portion of the program. We'll take questions from the audience as you all bring them forward, and there are people to collect those. Meanwhile, I'll start with one. Each of you has proposed reforms that are likely to require more state revenue or savings in state revenue at some point, whether that's education reform, mental health reform, or criminal justice reform. What adjustments do you think are needed in the state's tax policy and/or budgeting in order to either generate new revenue or free up revenue for your proposals? And we'll start with Mr. Harding.
I'll note that one of the best parts about the Commonwealth of Virginia is the fact that we have a balanced budget. It's a requirement. And the day that that goes away is going to be a sad day for the Commonwealth. I'll also note that some of the policies that the Democratic Party is proposing in various ways are going to require significant revenue increases in order to pay for them. And what we've heard from candidates throughout the Commonwealth is the idea of progressive tax income taxation. And some folks have even considered and tossed around the idea of going after the balanced budget requirement altogether. These are things that are dangerous, and you should be wary of such ideas. As far as what I would do, the first place I would start is in the legalization of cannabis in Virginia, and this is why I'll note it. We spent $63 million last year arresting 29,000 people for a 20-year high of arrestees from illegal cannabis. Meanwhile, if you look at the amount of revenue that could come through a legalization, it would be over $200 million. That's a $263 million a year swing. That could be used for a lot of things. Whether that's used for beds in our mental health centers, whether it's used for body cams or increasing home incarceration instead of detention for nonviolent offenders, whether it's used for substance abuse rehabilitation or increasing funding to our community services boards. There are a litany of ways that $263 million can be used. I'll also note that there are other ways that we can derive revenue without increasing taxation directly on income or corporate taxes. And plus, there's plenty of waste to go around as well that we could cut and trim.
All right. Thank you. We'll move next to Mr. Deeds.
Sure. I get around the state pretty much, and I've not heard any legitimate candidate talking about doing away with the balanced budget requirement in the state law. That's pretty much embedded, and it's not going to change. But the reality is we rely on a lot of bonded indebtedness. That's written into the code, written into the Constitution as well. Where I think we have the most room in terms of revenue or in terms of new money is in if we reconsider the tax credits that have been granted. More than $2 billion in tax credits are issued every year in Virginia. Those credits go from a lot of things that a lot of us agree with, a lot of things that make sense, for example, for a land conservation tax credit program. I was a sponsor of that bill back in 1998. It's been the most successful land conservation program in the country. But there are other tax credits that probably they haven't accomplished what they were set out to do. For example, there's a coal-related tax credit that's not increased jobs in the coal fields, yet we spend hundreds of millions of dollars on that every year. I think we can reconsider some of those tax credits. We can probably come up with the revenue we think we need for some of the programs we want to accomplish. I think that there are, from time to time, various ideas about tax increases or tax cuts. We'll consider them when they come up, but from my perspective, the first place we look is with things that are already in the budget. We need to reexamine some of the tax credits.
Go ahead, Ms. Lauper.
Certainly, I would divide this up into the savings and new. And certainly, I've been on many panels now, so I've heard this several times, and I hate to reiterate, but yes, we need to relook at the tax credits that are given to corporations. Are they really effective? Is that what we need to be spending our money on? Also, we could talk about criminal justice reform. We know it costs about $38,000 a year to incarcerate somebody, and with our over use of, as we just heard in the last debate, you know, this is a way to cut taxpayers' money and not be using it for that. And I will tell you, no school board is spending $38,000 a year per pupil. So this is a way that we could absolutely be getting the money that we need to be supporting, as I would say, education. And then also, at least at the minimum, decriminalizing marijuana possession in small amounts. This is another way we are using taxpayer money to incarcerate and sometimes criminalize poverty in ways that isn't good for the use of our taxpayer money. So these would be all ways that we could be looking at utilizing taxpayer money properly for things that we know will increase the economy, like investing in education, investing in broadband, investing in healthcare.
Thank you. So we have a submitted question that kind of follows up on that. The question is, the change in federal tax law in 2018 resulted in what some have called a windfall in Virginia tax revenue. So, should Virginia modify its tax law, or should the extra revenue be used for good purposes? And we'll start with Mr. Deeds on this one.
I'm not sure that it's going to be a windfall that's ongoing. We had a windfall this year, and the decision was made. I don't know that it was the best decision, but the decision was made to send refunds back to taxpayers, $110 a taxpayer, right before the election, $220 a couple. Those checks have already started coming out. I've seen a couple of them for different clients of mine in my law practice. I don't know that surpluses will continue. You know, the long-term revenue projections for Virginia suggest that we are going into a somewhat of a downturn. We're going to have several years where our revenues are not going to be as robust as they've been. So I certainly don't think that at this point we can we're going to have the ability to wrap any more federal tax reform into Virginia's law.
And next, Ms. Laufer, would you take that?
Well, I think what it's important to note is that our federal deficit has increased with this change in tax law. And as Senator Deeds has said, we've gotten, $110 a person or $220 a couple. You know, the proposal originally from our governor was to actually invest it in the very things I just talked about, education, broadband, and health care. And we know in my district, 25% of the district does not have broadband. Imagine to yourself going home right now and not being able to access your computer, your internet. You know, we are leaving children behind. We're leaving businesses behind. We can't expand telemedicine without broadband. And I agree that we don't know if this is going to be a permanent tax cut. And I would say, you know, we need to be thinking about this in a more holistic way and realizing that the tax break that we just got was actually, we borrowed money for that. And in my opinion, you don't want to borrow money for something like that. That increased our federal deficit substantially. And I don't think we can count on it going forward.
Next.
Yes, I think they're both right. We're not going to see that annually. That was a one-time windfall for Virginia due to the accounting and the way that the revenues were generated. I do agree with the returning the funds, though, to the taxpayers. $110 for a person or $220 for a couple is a significant amount of money. That can pay for groceries, that can pay for the utilities, that can pay for cell phone bills, that can pay for the supplies or the clothes. We're entering the fall. Maybe somebody doesn't have that coat, have those clothes. I mean, $220 for families is good. It's good. And insofar as this is taxpayers' money, not the governor's money to use for whatever program he's going to choose today, it should be returned to folks, and I'm glad that it was. I'll note something, though, about the federal tax cuts that I do think Virginia should double down on, and that is the opportunity zones. The federal government created these opportunity zones that the governor then chose hundreds of them throughout Virginia, areas where your capital gains taxes are either decreased or frozen, depending on how long you invest in these areas that could use the help. I think Virginia needs to follow that model and do our best to eliminate the tax burdens in those areas as well, as much as possible, so that Virginia can see the growth and investment, whether it be in inner city communities or rural communities that could use the help. And so that's a model that came out of the federal tax cut bill that I think that Virginia could add an extra layer to support it as well.
Thank you. So this next question also as a tax component, we'll go with Ms. Laufer first, Mr. Harding and Mr. Deeds. This is a little bit complicated. Charlottesville City Council has more flexibility to tax than our Albemarle County. So that's a tax component. And that is because of the Dillon Rule. Do you see a need to change the Dillon Rule, and why or why not? So Ms. Laufer.
Sure. So the Dillon Rule really is the state telling the localities that they have to, especially with taxes, clear it through the General Assembly before they put a new tax on to any residents. And cities are different than counties. And it's not just about taxing authority. It's about a lot of other issues that we see localities want to make their own determination on. And I think it really is important that we look at the Dillon Rule and how effective is it today, and is it really as appropriate as it was when it was first brought up. So I definitely think Dillon Rule should be something that the General Assembly looks at.
All right, and then next, Mr. Harding.
I see it as a two-part question. First of all, I don't want to give Albemarle County any more creative authority to create taxes, okay? There are candidates running here in the county that say they are going to, quote, get creative in the ways that they generate tax revenue. I don't want to see that. I also don't want to see them taxing, you know, rain or taxing anything else that you can come up with. Now, insofar as the Dillon Rule is concerned, I do generally have issues in about half of what the Dillon Rule does, and this is why. I'm a small government guy. I think that local government should have more impact and more influence on your day-to-day than Richmond, and of course Richmond should have more than Washington. I think that's the way America was meant to be, and I think that the smallest government is the best government. With that being said, I don't think it's appropriate to go straight to a traditional home rule system where every county and every city has autonomy to dictate what does and can and cannot happen. You need to have some notice as to what's illegal. If someone is used to walking around and open carrying in their park in Fluvanna and they want to go with their children to go visit a park in Crozet, they need to have adequate notice that they're not going to be violating some law and get thrown into jail. If you have a get rid of the Dillon Rule and go straight to a home rule, you're going to have county by county, city by city, criminal codes, tax codes, business regulations, permitting requirements. So what I would like to see is localities being able to opt out of the state's requirements. That would eliminate the impact of unfunded mandates. It would allow for localities, if they don't want to enforce a particular thing, whether it be a crime or a regulation or a permitting requirement, they can do so in the name of budgetary, you know, constraint or civil liberties or whatever they need to. But they can't raise the ceiling as to what you're required or not allowed to do. I don't want them to impose spot-by-spot criminal codes, regulations, permitting requirements, but I do think they should be able to opt out of them.
The Dillon Rule grew out of an Iowa state court case in the 1870s, and what the Dillon Rule basically says is that localities can only do the things that the state says they can do. The Dillon Rule has been modified a number of times, and for example, a place where I favor modifying the Dillon Rule would be one that that gives local governments the ability to control firearms, carrying of firearms in the building, in public buildings or in public parks or in public permitted activities like what happened here in August of 2017. The issue with respect to taxation, cities can tax at a different things at a different level than counties can. That doesn't always reflect the changing nature of counties. You know, a county like my home is Bath County. Bath County is a very rural county and hadn't changed a whole lot in terms of the overall makeup of the county in the last 100 years. Some of the communities have changed, and there have been a variety of people moving in and out, but the taxation basically is the same as it's always been, and I don't really see a need for change. A place like Albemarle County or James City County or Henrico County or Fairfax County has seen significantly more growth, and what you might need to consider for a certain urban growth counties, a certain group of counties where you've seen more growth, you might need to consider setting up a special form of government for them, or a special exception for them under the Dillon Rule. But that's another debate that we've not had yet. That is something that we have to recognize the changing nature of some of our communities.
The next question, I'll give the order. Mr. Harding, Mr. Deeds, Ms. Laufer. The question is, our psychiatric hospitals are operating at near capacity. What are your ideas toward reducing the need for hospitalizations in the first place and for providing more pre-crisis preventative services in the community? And again, Mr. Harding first.
It's a very broad issue. There are a lot of ways to go about it. Insofar as the hospitals are full, we do need more beds. No matter what solutions we provide to preemptive care or making sure that folks never need to go to a hospital, we're going to need more beds no matter what. And so I mentioned one way of adding revenue to the increasing beds earlier in certain types of criminal justice reforms. I also think that we could pull some of the funding from the criminal justice system into the mental health system, because right now, if you look at the largest mental health provider in Virginia, it's the prison system, and it's a problem. We are over-incarcerating people who have mental health issues, and we need to revert some of those revenues into the mental health system and away from jail cells. So that's something I would like to do. I'll also note that you know, we have issues with the transport system. Every sheriff I've talked to in the 25th District has explained that they have a problem right now where when a deputy goes and picks somebody up with an emergency order, they have to go and sit with them for 8 hours at any particular location that they're at. We need to reconstruct and vertically integrate the way that folks are transported and secured during these processes. And then ultimately, we need to recognize that mental health is an ongoing thing with somebody. It's a personal experience that we need to have earlier diagnoses. If we have physical education in schools, we need to have some components of mental education in schools. Our ratio, I think it's 1 to 3,000 in Virginia for a mental health service provider in our school systems. That ratio needs to come down so that folks can know earlier in their lives, you know, whether they're battling anxiety, whether they're battling depression, whether they're battling something that may require, you know, lifetime psychiatric help or you know, other types of rehabilitation or help along the way. Things can compound if we don't get in front of them earlier, and I'd like to get them in our schools as
Thank
well.
Thank you. Mr. Deeds, next.
Yes. This is something I could talk for a long time about. We have roughly 18 hospital beds for every 100,000 in terms of population. The national average is 11 hospital beds per every 100,000 population. We spend more money nationally. States spend about 70% of their mental health dollar in the community and 30% in the hospitals. We spend a little bit more than 50% in the hospitals. The question was multiple. A lot of what Mr. Harding said is absolutely correct. We're incarcerating too many people with mental illness. We began the deinstitutionalization in 1963. We reinstitutionalized a bunch of those folks. Somewhere between 16 and 24% of the people that are in our jails and prisons have serious mental illness. And that does not include the people that have substance abuse addictions. That does not include the people who are in a crisis or too often. Mental health is somebody else's problem. Here, the reality is, 1 in 5 of us will have a mental health crisis in our life. 1 in 5 of us, 1 in 25 of us. About that. That's why ultimately, of the 400,000 people that are going to be eligible for Medicaid expansion, between 50 and 60,000 of those people have serious mental illness. 1 in 25 of us will have serious mental illness. So this is a significant issue. What I think we need to do instead of building more beds because we can't afford it. We just can't afford it if we're going to be able to provide people efficiently. We have to invest more money in community services. We've got to advance mental health rebuild through the DMAS, through Medicaid expansion, so we can put more money in intensive outpatient treatment and put more money in partial hospitalization programs. There are a lot of things we can do. It's an incredibly complicated and important question.
Thank you. And next, Ms. Lauper.
I agree with everything that everyone said. I think also, we also have a lack of mental health care workers, okay? And a lot of times that's because their wages are so depressed and they can't afford to live. And I would also say, if we're really looking at the spectrum of people, looking at schools and investing properly in fully funding our schools, starting with preschool, starting with the support staff that we need in the schools, we know that we have one counselor per 450 students. I mean, that's not viable. So looking at the whole spectrum, also how are we recruiting people to go into mental health services? Also, I would just reiterate, we do know that many people incarcerated have mental health illnesses, and it's such a broader issue. Focusing on support staff in our schools, I believe, and also making sure that we have more mental health care workers and providers. I think we know that we're seeing there's not enough. And part of that, I think, is because they don't get paid very much and it's high burnout. So making sure they have the right kind of environment so that they can sustain themselves. It's a multi-pronged approach, I would say.
Well, I think we're going to shift gears here for a little bit. We've had a couple of questions submitted about the environment. So I'm going to try to summarize this one, which basically says there are numerous environmental issues facing Virginia. Just to cite a few, the need to reduce greenhouse gases and rapidly convert from fossil fuels to renewable energy, the fact that DEQ does not have enough staff or funding, and the fact that we're pulling too much groundwater from our reservoirs and aquifers. So what are some of the changes to state laws, regulations, and other actions and or funding that you would support to address environmental problems? Mr. Deeds, we'd like to start with you.
DEQ was created back in the mid-90s, basically by putting together the water board, the air board, and the waste board to create a one-stop shop. The whole idea was that anybody who needed a permit for environmental work could go to one place and get their work done, and it'd be more efficient. And it would, DEQ was basically paid for by permit fees. What pays for DEQ doesn't come from the general fund, except it comes from permit fees. An industry that needs a regulatory permit pays a fee, and that's what pays for DEQ. However, the permit fees have not caught up with the work. In other words, the permit fees only cover about 5%, 10% of the work, and we're having to make up the rest with general fund dollars. So I think the first thing we need to look to those permit fees. For people that operate landfills, there's a downside to all of this. It's going to increase the cost of doing business. But if we're going to do things, and we're going to expect DEQ to do things, and we are, we're going to have to find a way to pay for it somehow. So a couple of years ago, I had a couple of bills to require DEQ or allow DEQ to stop work on these pipelines when environmental erosion problems occurred. Well, the reality is the fees, the permit fees, are paid by the pipeline developers. Well, those fees are not enough to cover the work. We're going to have to step that up if we're going to require DEQ to do more, and we ought to. You know, there are a lot of these environmental things that concern me. My youngest daughter lives in Alaska. And I would suggest that anyone who has questions about climate change visit Alaska, because there you can see more dramatically the impact of the human behavior, human conduct on climate change. It's real, it's existential, and we're going to have to take it seriously.
And we'll go to Ms. Laufer next.
So greenhouse gases, renewable energy. Just want to make sure, and groundwater shortage. Mm-hmm. Actually, I didn't mention.
And the DEQ.
I do have a degree in geology. I did hydrogeology for the state of Wisconsin before going into the Peace Corps. So I'm very passionate about the environment, and that's part of why I want to run, because I think we need to have science people making these decisions. In terms of renewable, we know that the General Assembly passed about two sessions ago that one-third of our energy would be from renewable sources by 2030. I think that's a great first start. We do know, though, that for us to actually have that to happen, we need to improve our grid. And that has to be done, I think, with more funding and knowing that Dominion is the person or the organization that is in charge of this. I think, first of all, we have to make sure that they're not funding politicians, because the regulatory board is the General Assembly. So making sure that Dominion is held responsible. Improving our grid. We also know that there is a cap right now. If you have solar panels on your home or your business, you can't sell back fully the energy that you're not using. It's a capped at 1%. And we know that if we want to get to renewable, we have to allow people to sell back fully the energy that they're producing. We also have the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. That was a regional program for the Eastern Seaboard. We didn't adopt it. I think we should. We should be reducing our greenhouse gases. And in terms of groundwater, I can tell you, as somebody that studied water chemistry, you know, it's so important to make sure our watershed is not polluted, because it is very, very difficult to fix that once that happens, especially with groundwater. And as I said, a lot of my district is rural. Many people are on wells, and once that happens, it's almost impossible to clean up.
Okay, thank you. We're going to run out of time before we get all our questions answered. So let's not do that. I'm going to take one more.
Can I answer?
I'm so sorry. Thank you.
I'd be happy to answer this one, too. I'm going to start with the unholy alliance we have with Dominion Energy. Okay, Dominion Energy started off with their sole source monopoly of being a public utility in a good space. Okay, my grandfather was once the head of the electric workers union in Virginia, laying the grid, building the power plants throughout Virginia, and it was at a time when return on investment wasn't there to build the grid in rural areas, and so we gave them the sole source contract. Well, those days are gone. And yes, we could use a more secure smart grid, but at the end of the day, they don't need to have that monopoly. Insofar as they are given that monopoly, which they have, they need to be buying green energy that's going on the grid. Apex Energy here, a local Albemarle, Charlottesville-based green tech alternative energy company, wants to put a wind farm down in Botetourt County. They have the land for it, got all the permits for it, you know, bought the land, went, jumped through all the hoops, but they can't find anybody to buy the energy. Well, guess what? Dominion needs to be buying that energy without raising your rates, because that's the type of relationship you need to have if you're going to continue to be able to use the government to do your bidding. Otherwise, go on to the private sector. As far as CO2 emissions are concerned, I'll note that the best steward of the earth are our farmers, okay? Small farmers and forestry, and these folks in rural America take care of their land, they take care of their soil, and what they're growing pulls out CO2. And, you know, for very often we talk about the emission side of CO2. And I get that, but we need to start focusing on the capture side as well. The introduction of hemp into the Virginia crop market could be the biggest boon, not just for jobs, but also for cleaning the soil. It puts nutrients back into the soil, and it pulls out on average 3 to 4 times the CO2 of the average tree. If we reforested all the areas of the earth that we've already cut down, we'd pull out 2/3 of the CO2 we've produced. Why don't we back hemp production, back reforestation, and give them tax abatements along the way?
So one more quick, I hope it, I think this will be quick, environmental question. The order will be Ms. Lawfer, Mr. Harding, and Mr. Deeds. Will you return Dominion donations if you have received any?
So I took the pledge not to take Dominion money, and I haven't received any money from Dominion. And I would just say that really what we've allowed Dominion to do is to control our ecological and economic future of the Commonwealth.
I have pledged not to take any money from Dominion. I will never take money from Dominion. I think Dominion as a public utility should not be able to give any campaign money, because they're determining their own ratepayers, essentially. I mean, you've got the Virginia consumer and residents over a barrel, and then you sit there and pad the lines of both parties. And because I'm a first-time candidate, they haven't come knocking on my door. But I'll note that they've come knocking on every other person's door, elected or running, multiple times in Virginia. They sent me an email last week saying we'd love to get together and talk about Dominion. I have their lobbyist phone numbers. They know I'm going to be a hostile party unless they start becoming a good actor. And to say, I know that the Democratic Party took a pledge not to take any more money from them, but that doesn't mean every Democratic elected official is not going to take money from them and then siphon it off to each other's PACs. Look at our governor. Our governor is one of the biggest lackeys for Dominion in the history of the Commonwealth of Virginia. That's the fact. That's the only reason he was able to withstand the KKK Klan scandal, is because they went through and did the digging on Justin Fairfax and ultimately propped up their man because they saw a threat in the LG's office. They are scared no matter what party you are, because they control Virginia. So no, I'm not taking their money, and they can go ahead and go on record that if elected, I'm going to do everything I can to make them either act right or get out of the public utility monopolistic structure.
All right, the next question.
I got that question too. I ran 6 times for the House of Delegates. This is the 6th time I've run for the Senate. I ran 2 statewide campaigns. I haven't taken Dominion money since 2016, and I'm not going to give it back. I'm not making any apologies. I'm not making any apologies for not being an independently wealthy private guy that was educated in private schools that can fund my own campaigns. I've been a guy who has to work for a living, and I've raised a lot of money over the years. Now, there's three levels of analysis. I've been criticized by certain parties for taking money from Dominion over the years. There's three levels of analysis you have to do for that money. Number one, yeah, I took over $100,000 from Dominion over the last 28 years. Number two, I took most of that money from Dominion in the years 03 to 09 when I was running for statewide office. When Dominion funds all statewide offices. They fund everybody. They give out money to just about everybody. Number three, look at my record. What you will find is that in 28 years of the legislature, I've got one of the most independent records with respect to utility regulation. Even Steve Hainer, who was an executive director of the Republican House Caucus in the early 90s and late 80s, said recently on a blog, Bacon's Rebellion blog, that I'm one of the only two people in the Senate that's been pro-consumer over the years, that's been absolutely pro-consumer. So, yes, I took money, Dominion money in the past. I've not taken it since 2016. I'm not going to take it again, but I'm not giving anything back.
So the order for this question will be Mr. Deeds, Mr. Harding, Ms. Offer. What kinds of firearms regulations do you think are appropriate for Virginia to pass? And how would you work with the rest of the General Assembly to get that taken care of, Mr. Deeds?
I probably, I grew up in Bath County. I probably learned to shoot about the time I learned to read. I hunted most of my childhood. I'm not an athlete, so I'd spend my afternoons in the fall of the year. Instead of it being a football practice, I'd be out shooting at birds and squirrels and rabbits. But in life, you kind of, my friend Chip Woodrum used to put it this way: I always reserve the right to be smarter tomorrow than I am today. The last gun legislation that passed the General Assembly was a bill that I carried that prevents young people that are under the age of 18 years old that have been subject to a temporary detention order from being able to purchase a gun when they're 18 years. That was a loophole in Virginia law that resulted in a tragedy up in Stafford County and almost a tragedy in Albemarle County. Once we became aware of it, we changed that law 2 years ago. I've carried bills the last 2 years to basically give, at the request of Charlottesville and Albemarle County, to give local governments the ability to control firearms in public spaces and in public assemblies. But I think there's some other things we can do. For example, states that have passed universal background checks have seen a reduction in firearm crimes. We've already decided felons and people that have been subject to temporary detention orders shouldn't have firearms. We ought to have the tool to be able to make sure that those people don't get firearms. That's what universal background checks can prove. Red flag laws have been passed in 18 states. They've been shown to reduce the number of people who die by suicide by the use of a firearm and to be able to make domestic difficulties less lethal. So I think those bills will pass, and I'll support them, but there will probably be other bills too.
And Mr. Harding?
The first thing I would do is I would allow those under the age of 21 who are the victims of protective orders to be able to concealed carry. They're not allowed to do that in Virginia. I represent a young woman who's 19 years old in rural Albemarle County, works on a horse farm by herself, born and raised in a family that's trained in firearms, and she has a protective order against an ex-boyfriend who was an abuser. He was found with a firearm against the law, didn't show up to court. She wants to be able to protect herself when she's walking around town, but it has to be open. She should be able to have a concealed weapons permit if she's, the victim of a protective order. So that's the first thing I would do to be able to protect yourself, because the Second Amendment is a fundamental liberty to be able to defend yourself, defend your family, defend the weaker, defend your home, defend yourself against an oppressive and inefficient government. Everybody thinks it's crazy to think that, oh my gosh, you're going to fight the tyranny with your guns. But in reality, it's an inefficient and ineffective government. It's Amber Geiger walking into the wrong apartment, shooting a man on his couch. That's the type of government I'm talking about. Not some giant army rolling in tomorrow. It's being able to defend yourself. I'll also note that, yes, we mentioned that felons all lose their firearm rights, but in Virginia, and I know it's federally imposed as well, but nonviolent felons have lost their firearms rights, and I have to go, and they have to pay me, I try to reduce it, to be able to go get their firearms rights back. And depending on which jurisdiction they're in, they probably won't. But nonviolent felons didn't lose their firearm rights until 1961, when a lot of racism was going down. And it's one of the most racist things in the history of the United States, because you make them dependent on an over-police state in an area where the poor are disproportionately impacted by violent crime. They need to be able to protect themselves. So I would be willing to relook at that. Now, the type of gun regulations you're probably talking about, I'd be willing to look at a civil penalty for the negligent sale of a firearm without conducting a background check if the person you sold to would have otherwise failed the background check and they go off and commit a crime with that firearm. That's something I would look at.
All right, thank you.
Well, I can say I grew up in a hunting family. You know, I can say the first time my husband came home, it was Thanksgiving. There's a slew of dead animals and a lot of guns. And my husband's like, are you trying to scare me off or something? I mean, that's Thanksgiving. But I can also say my children go to school. And my son came home one night and said to me, you know, Mom, I don't think we could all fit behind the teacher's desk. And my daughter said to me, you know, Mom, every time I walk into the school, I wonder who is going to be the one that will do this. And I am, quite frankly, one of many parents that when the school calls, I do have a pang of wondering, is this it? You know, that's what's happening. We have a generation of children that are terrified, and quite frankly, many adults going to the movie theater, going to the grocery store. We're worried. We're scared. We know the majority of Americans, the majority of Virginians, want universal background checks. We know the majority of Americans, the majority of Virginians want red flag laws. When you're a family member or a person you love is in crisis, the local authority could be alerted and their weapons could be temporarily taken away. These are things that the majority of Virginians, the majority of Americans agree on. And also banning high capacity magazines. You know, we have to be honest about what our children are facing and what we are also facing. So those would be things I would be interested in.
Thank you. So we've reached the end of the question portion of the program, and I didn't get to everybody's questions. I apologize for that. Thank you for providing topics for our conversation. Thanks to the candidates. And now the closing statements will be 2 minutes each. And the order will be Mr. Deeds, Mr. Harding, and Ms. Laufer.
Can I just ask, where did Bryce Reed?
As far as I know, he didn't respond.
Stay on track.
Okay.
He was invited, and he did not choose.
That didn't count against me. Thank you so much. Thank you for the questions. I want you to know that service in the Senate has been an honor, been an incredible honor. I can tell you it's one of the honors of my life to be able to participate. It's something I still get goosebumps about when I go into that Capitol building to work. And I thank you for that. I thank you for your questions today. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of them. You know, service in the legislature, in any legislative body, is hard work. You know, we take sides. You know, we're Democrats or Republicans or independents or whatever we want to call ourselves, but we have to work with whomever is elected. Whoever, you know, what I tell people is I get to vote for one senator and one delegate, but my job is to work with whomever else is elected to try to get things done. And I think over the years, I've proven that I can be part of big things, getting big things done, and I still have big things that I have to do. You know, this mental health reform that I'm working on now is critical work that I can tell you people around the country are watching. We have their attention. We are getting things done. We are moving in the right direction, but we aren't nearly there. I've said to people in the past that mental health reform is like eating an elephant. You take a big bite and you feel satisfied, but then you look at everything else that's in front of you to do and you realize how little you've accomplished. We have so much work to do. And I've been able to get that accomplished, even though I've been in the minority, even though, you know, people like Rob Bell and Emmett Hanger that are close by have been partners of mine in getting that work done. But we've been able to work across party lines to make sure we can move forward. We've got other things we have to work on. We have to build a commonwealth of opportunity everywhere in Virginia. We've got to continue to invest in education and transportation to make, and we have to put broadband everywhere. $19 million this year is great, but that's not enough to do one county. We have to do so much if we are going to create a commonwealth of opportunity throughout Virginia. I need your help on November 5th. I ask for your vote. Thank you very much.
Mr. Harding, thank you.
I'll note that I got in this race for a lot of reasons, but I'm a criminal defense attorney by trade and something I'm very passionate about. The number one issue facing Virginians is criminal justice reform. And if you didn't hear enough about it the last hour, I'm going to give you a little spiel about it. If my opponent was going to fix a lot of the things he was talking about, he would have already fixed them. Okay? You need to realize that. 18 years in the Senate, a decade before that, at a certain point, it's just not going to get done. In our last debate in Covington, he was hesitant to recognize that cannabis needs to be legalized in Virginia. He co-patroned legislation in the 90s to ban medical marijuana in Virginia. It's that type of hesitancy that took him over a decade to realize that our gay neighbors have civil rights, that in his 1999 recorder bill, that's a page that said no special rights for gays. It took him Obergefell against Hodges to realize that gay people should be able to get married. It took him Roper against Simmons to realize that juveniles shouldn't be executed. I've already pledged that my first bill will end capital punishment in Virginia because it's time. I will also fully back the legalization of cannabis because we don't have the time, and 29,000 people next year or this year don't have the time to get arrested for something and wait for us to change our minds. It has to be done. I'll note, though, that the race that a lot of people are focusing on in Albemarle is the Commonwealth's attorney's race. And I see interest in both candidates, but I'm a small government person who respects the Constitution, and I want to recognize that respecting your branch is appropriate. A lot of the things that candidate Hensley refers to, like ending the death penalty, mass incarceration, marijuana prohibition, cash bail, mandatory minimums, paying public defenders, I want to see automatic expungement of acquittals. I want to see community reentry focused on. All of these things need to be done at this level. You need to respect the law.
That's time. Thank you.
And vote, hopefully, on November 5th for me. Thank you.
And let's give Ms. Lawfer a chance. Thank you.
I want to say thank you all again for coming out today and to the Virginia Statesman. This might be the last time we meet here because I know the Senior Center is going to be opening their doors across town. So, you know, for me, this really isn't about politics. I want to work on solving problems that my family and families like all of us across the Commonwealth are facing. This district, actually, because I didn't get the chance, it's Eastern Albemarle, parts of Culpeper, all of Orange County, most of Louisa, half of Spotsylvania, and all of Fredericksburg. It's big, it's varied in needs, but I want to ensure that we have access to affordable, quality health care. I want to make sure that our children are able to have a successful and great education that prepares them for their future. I want to help expand broadband so that our children are not left behind, our business are not left behind, and I want to make sure that we ensure that Virginia continues to have a strong economy that can benefit everyone. And I'm here today because I want to do the work. I've been to at least three forums and several different legislative discussions, and my opponent has never been at one of them. I'm here because I want to represent us and I want to do the work. And I humbly ask for your vote on November 5th. Thank you.
And I want to add something here in my role as moderator, because Mr. Harding introduced some additional topics at the end in criticism of his opponent. I would like to give Mr. Deeds
sure.
30 seconds
and,
to respond.
And I appreciate that. You know, I can't go back 28 years. I don't know about everything he just challenged me to. But you know, what I will say is that, you know, H.L. Mencken said consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. My friend Chip Woodrum put it this way: I reserve the right to be smarter tomorrow than I am today. I hope that if I made mistakes in the past, I've grown past those mistakes. And I think I've shown in the last 28 years of service that I can get things done in the legislature, and I can get things done whether I'm in the minority or the majority. I can't get everything done unless I can get a majority to agree with me.
All right. Thank you. That wraps it up. I appreciate y'all coming. See you at the polls on November 5th.